Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, One Small Step. Some of you remember the day when man first stepped onto the moon. My eyes were glued to my aunt's black and white TV mounted in a hi-fi console. It was a time when the nation had a focus on that one small step from the last rung of Eagle's ladder to the surface of another world. President Kennedy was an Irish Catholic redhead with an amazing New England accent that seemed to draw everyone into the whirlwind of his expression. He wasn't like a Roman emperor who sponsored state games to keep the people amused while he put the people's wealth up his nose. He was a leader. I remember someone telling me the difference between a leader and a manager. A manager does things right, and a leader does the right thing. In those days, America was caught up in a Cold War. After World War II, the spoils of technology, exasperated people, and entire countries burned into desolation were up for grabs. The Soviets were trying to become the new British Empire, and the Americans chose themselves to be the neighborhood watch to keep them from doing it. After all, America was the only nation that never saw the sole of a foreign soldier's boot nor heard the growl of guns from an airplane over its streets. American factories ran around the clock without a single interruption from its enemies. Somehow, the oceans were like a wormhole that only we had the codes for passing through freely. The war was over there. The Cold War seemed to press the possibility onto our consciousness like the fear of a great dragon lurking silently in a sleeping vigil, as though waiting for an inattentive moment in which to turn the party into cinders. I remember the drills at school. The horn would blare, and we would roll under our desks and put our hands over our heads. Looking back, it was about as effective as holding a tissue up to stop a charging bull. It would have at least have provided a millisecond of beauty to stand out on the playground and watch the initial blast with wide open eyes. Either way, it would have ended the human presence again on Earth for thousands of years. Truly, the mutually assured destruction strategy was insane. I suppose it was a good thing both superpowers were insane at the same time. I mean, what nation in their right mind would ever actually use a nuclear weapon against a city full of people? The clarity I gained, having served in the Air Force at the tropical paradise of Grand Forks Air Force Base in North Dakota, established a curiosity about national defense policy that never ended. In fact, what I'm about to tell you may shock you. It isn't meant to. I only want you to realize that the game mastered after World War I by Dawes and Young, with their financial windfall of making enormous profits by selling machines and weapons to both sides, has been refined to a level beyond the imagination. It changed the world in only a few years. Ancient history proves it works this way every time it is employed. We're going to go there in this chapter, beyond your imagination. But don't worry, you'll be traveling with me. The mad battle plan was so carefully played out by all the enemies in the Cold War that it became abundantly clear that the first one to strike wins. In the battle plan, both sides placed short-range nuclear weapons hidden offshore of their enemy's command and control headquarters. 80% of the world's population lives within 20 miles of a coast, and for goodness sake, the U.S. capital was within a couple of flying minutes from the Atlantic Ocean. The next step was to design a massive electromagnetic pulse, an EMP weapon. It doesn't reach the ground. This weapon was designed to produce a 50 megaton pulse that would simply be housed in the cargo bay of an ordinary aircraft. flying an ordinary airway route and flown at an altitude of about 40,000 feet. Somewhere around the epicenter of all electrical grids in the Northeast, a split-second ballet would take place. You can play some Lisa Gerrard music here, because there won't be any other sound while this happens. When the pieces were all in place, and the threat was that they were always in place, the following sequence was to unfold. The EMP weapon explodes at about 8 miles above the Earth. Within seconds, the entire electrical grid shuts down, and all radio communications cease. At nearly the speed of light, all satellites go dark. All power grids go dark. This was designed to happen on a night with light winds from the west, clear skies, and a massive moment of inattention, such as New Year's Eve or Easter Sunday or Christmas. It wasn't so much the symbolism or the fulfillment of some Nostradamus quatrain. Rather, it was calculated to be a moment when the people, including the leadership, looked somewhere else. Within seconds, the offshore short-range missiles would be launched. No one would know they are coming at Mach 6, because all the electricity and phones are already dead. They would strike their targets in about 5 minutes or less. They would be precisely targeted to hit the command and control center, such as Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Florida, North Carolina, etc. The instant the short-range missiles are launched, the long-range ICBMs would launch. It takes about 30 minutes for these to leave their silos, travel into space, and plunge back to their targets below. Each missile holds numerous warheads. Each warhead is programmed to strike the ability of the enemy to strike back. The missiles are 90% accurate, and important targets were to be hit twice, improving the effectiveness to 99%. The entire attack would be over in less than 30 minutes. The vast majority of the nation would know nothing about it, unless you have a missile silo in your backyard, or you live within driving distance of a command and control center. You would simply wake up late in the morning. Your alarm won't go off. Your phones won't work. Your car won't start. No stores are open. No fuel pumps are running. The only thing you hear will be that strange Lisa Gerrard music I started a few paragraphs back. Life will suddenly collapse to a much simpler time. Suddenly, 300 million people will be on their own. There will be no counterstrike. The aggressor will issue an immediate ceasefire order offering peace. There won't be any invasion. No troops will ever set foot in the other country. The loser will have more important things to think about. In less than an hour, they will be a third world country. When the milk sours in the markets and people run out of cereal and bread and soup and water, they will begin to move. I saw this firsthand. I was in the 1969 earthquake at Selmar, California. Our little Simi Valley in California was isolated from the city. Our water was cut off. Groceries were seized by the Red Cross and the National Guard, sealed off the canyon road. The aftershocks kept us all sleepless for days. Fortunately, the utilities were restored within a couple of days. What would have happened if the utilities did not come back for 2 years? This was the Cold War. The public did not know this. We were led to believe that we would somehow knock out those evil missiles and that we would be able to strike back and win a nuclear exchange. It simply was not true. Likewise, it was not true for the Soviets as well. There was a subtle and powerful unknown that kept us safe during those years. The Soviets did not know what President Kennedy would do. Would he attack first? The Soviets decided to hedge their bets by placing missiles with an ally in Cuba, Our spy planes photographed the whole thing, and President Kennedy didn't pick up the red phone for a private chat. He went to the television and told them that if they did not turn around those cargo ships, we would declare war on them. The fact that you are peacefully reading this book is a testament that they did turn around and go home. Soviet submarines would have to be the forward launch points from then on. For another 25 years, silent tubes of titanium were submerged with ready commanders trained to carry out the short-range attacks on a moment's notice. The EMP blast never announced the runners could leap out of their starting blocks. The race lost interest and ran out of money. Here we are in the 21st century with no army to fight. Thank God those days are over forever. So why are we still spending $1.3 trillion annually on national defense? That is one of the greatest questions of the millennia. Why indeed? Rather than soil my shoes by walking down the conspiracy path, I'm going to offer an experiment. Since I live by the scientific method, let's form a hypothesis, an experiment to prove or disprove the hypothesis, and form a theory, which may later become an axiom for human civilization. America currently has 50 states and a few territories who want to become states and a few states that no longer want to be. There are about 300 million, with about that many realities as well. There is an average reality that we call mortal life. Humans have a productive lifespan of about 80 years, removing pre-adolescence and the tarnished portion of the golden years from the equation. 50 is the new 30, you know. Okay, let's state the hypothesis. A peaceful human race through extreme challenge, unlimited education, and adequate food, water, and facilities. There are already a few facts that we have gathered from empirical evidence that will help with the design of the experiment. We watched America pull together and focus technology and national will on the race to the moon. We take it for granted now, but technology has scarcely utilized transistors when the first space launches were accomplished. Did you know that Ranger 4 missed the moon by 37,000 miles? Space scientists know how to compensate by subtracting the extra energy supplied by rotational access to the extra-dimensional torsion. But most do not know how to capitalize on the energy. Not yet, anyway. We also know that nearly all the funding for space programs originates with the industrial-military complex. Yes, it does exist. It also spends far more than $1.3 trillion a year on national defense, but there's no way to discover how much is spent or the results of the spending. That, too, is the subject of another book. We also know of a couple of other facts. Nearly every nation spends money on national defense. This is where the experiment is going to get interesting. Remember when Kennedy applied his leadership to place America on the moon within a decade? Why? I suppose, and this is a scientific supposition, that humans are explorers first and not warriors by nature. I think lover is ranked in there somewhere as well. With that supposition, here is the experiment. What would happen if America applied 75% of its defense budget, which is about $975 billion, officially speaking, of course, a year to the exploration and colonization of the moon? This is a radical shift in the application of funding. This is more money than has ever been applied to any effort other than buying votes or conquering people. This would require some resources in people, scientists, engineers, and skilled technicians to invent and manufacture everything. The moon has plenty of water and oxygen, but they're locked up in the soil. The moon has no protective magnetosphere and very little atmosphere, so accommodations would have to be built under the surface. Okay, you get the picture of how large the challenge would be. It fits the criteria for extreme challenge, to be sure. We can estimate that there will be some effects very similar to what Kennedy must have predicted when he was sitting in his top secret committee discussing his moon landing idea. He must have thought that it would make the Soviets catch the vision as well. Hey, wait a minute. What if they claim the moon? What's up there? What do they know that we don't? The Soviets were rubbing their hands together and fretting over whether to build more missiles or build more rockets to explore space. One thing is irrefutable. Every expert agrees on this. He who controls the moon shall control the earth. If America were to turn its budget for breaking things and killing people into one of national exploration and colonization of space, the entire world would change. Why do I say that? Because it will take much more than American brain power and money to make this happen. It will take Indian, Chinese, Japanese, Iranian, Iraqi, and Israeli engineers and scientists and money to make it happen. If we can conduct this experiment, there will be a global focus on extreme challenge that will require an unlimited amount of educated people. Educated people do not allow their social groups to grow beyond the environment's ability to support them. It is a biological fact that populations that grow too far in their environment will express warlike attributes. Rats, birds, and even bacteria display the same phenomena. Humans are intelligent and have will and desire, which animals do not. We do not need predators to limit our population the way rabbits and coyotes do. We can choose to limit our own growth to match our environment. We can plan for the future of our society and the future into the future we plan. The more successful we will be as a race upon this or any other planet. If we are focused as a planet on exploration and colonization of space, we are not killing each other. Besides that, it is much more fun to explore and live to tell about it. The discoveries and proliferation of technology necessary to propel and sustain humans into space will benefit the environment as well. We may be able to produce inexpensive clean drinking water from the sea, forming the first complete reusable water supply. We may be able to cheaply convert solar energy into electricity, which will allow our society to break away from the wired grid that forces us to live in concentrated areas. My company already utilizes a 1.4 square meter solar panel that outperforms anything the solar industry has ever seen. I can't give you any more details here without a signed non-disclosure statement by you. My associates haven't even gotten started yet. As long as we are challenged as a race, we will not seek the destruction of one another. We are immensely powerful and intelligent beings. From the earliest days, this biological transducer has walked this planet and allowed us to interpret the universe through its senses. We have looked up into the stars. As though longing to remember the way home, we have written songs and danced beneath them. We have pointed and wondered and even imagined what it would be like. Perhaps it is because we don't remember. Perhaps the spirit inside the body has existed beyond universes and has seen stars born, grow old, and die. Perhaps we are connected to the 96% of the universe we cannot perceive from this dimension. If we already explored the universe and chose Earth for the home of our children's children, why would we treat her so? I am proposing to save a nation with this book. I am asking you to reach down inside the universe, folded up inside each of you, and find the knowledge that peace and liberty can and must exist for mankind. I ask you to convene and to remove the agency government that sees the human race as sheep to be shorn. You are not sheep. You are a leaping, flying being without fear and with a capacity for love that is godlike. Save America. Save the human race. We have the will and a window of opportunity. Don't listen to the agency government that only demands your fair share to support their lifestyles. We do not have to step off the cliff into the valley of Armageddon like human races before us on this world. We are empowered with the conditional prediction of that future for the human race through a profit-driven war machine that sends children to kill one another. We can leap back from the edge. We do not have to follow that path. We can choose a new future. We can choose to release the agency government that is destroying us and return the power of government to the states where it belongs.